The next subheading is warning against fact hunting. Facts, even facts of the lowest order, cannot corrupt taste, while impressionistic criticism like that of Coleridge and Goethe is always misleading. The function of criticism is to educate taste, or, as Eliot puts it elsewhere, to promote enjoyment and understanding of literature. Now, facts, however trivial, can never corrupt taste. They can only gratify taste. Critics like Goethe or Coleridge, who supply opinion or fancy, are the real corruptors. In the end, Eliot cautions us not to become slaves to facts and bother about such trivialities as the laundry bills of Shakespeare. Such fact hunting is not criticism. Similarly, he warns us against the vicious taste for reading about works of art instead of regarding the works themselves. Eliot's emphasis on facts makes it clear that his critical stand is with such new critics as F.R. Leavis and I.A. Richards. He commends textual criticism, but he is against the lemon squeezer, a school of critics who try to squeeze every drop of meaning out of words. A critic should concentrate on text, compare and analyze, but he should never stoop to trivialities or empty hair splitting. A good critic is objective. His judgment is based on facts. He is guided by tradition, the accumulated wisdom of ages, and not by his inner voice. He does not indulge in mere expression of opinion or fancy. Eliot is against impressionistic criticism, but he does not expound any theories or lay down any rules and principles. Impressionistic criticism is erratic, while adherence to rigid theories hampers the critic and curtails his freedom. Conclusion: Eliot's objective attitude. The critic should be guided by facts and facts alone. He should approach the work of art with a free mind, unprejudiced by any theories or preconceived notions. Only then can he be completely objective and impersonal. It is in this way that criticism approximates to the position of science. It is only in this way that criticism becomes a cooperative activity. The critic of one age cooperates with critics of the previous ages in the common pursuit of truth. Such truths are provisional, for truths of one age are likely to be modified and corrected by truths discovered by future ages. In this objective scientific attitude, Eliot is different from all other previous English critics. He hides his individuality and originality. He is like a scientist working with an open mind and cooperating with others for the realization of truth, which he knows can only be tentative. Then point 6. The critic, his qualification, his functions. In a number of critical essays like The Perfect Critic, The Imperfect Critic, The Function of Criticism, The Frontiers of Criticism, Eliot has dealt with qualifications and functions of a critic. His views in this respect may be summed up as follows. The other subheading is Qualifications of an Ideal Critic. A good critic must be entirely impersonal and objective. He must not be guided by the inner voice, but by some authority outside him. Eliot instances two types of imperfect critics, represented by Arthur Symons and Arnold. Simmons is too subjective and impressionistic, while Arnold is too dry, intellectual, and abstract. Eliot regards Aristotle as an instance of a perfect critic, for he avoids both these defects. In his hands, criticism approaches the condition of science. Point number two. A good critic must not be emotional. He must be entirely objective. He must try to discipline his personal prejudices and whims. He must have a highly trained sensibility and a sense of a structural principle, and must not be satisfied with vague emotional impressions. Critics who supply only vague emotional impressions, opinions, or fancy, as he puts it, are great corruptors of taste. Point number three. An ideal critic must have a highly developed sense of fact. By a sense of fact, Eliot does not mean biographical or sociological knowledge, but a knowledge of technical details of a poem, its genesis, setting, etc. It is a knowledge of such facts alone which can make criticism concrete as well as objective. It is these facts which a critic must use to bring about an appreciation of a work of art. However, he is against the lemon squeezer, a school of critics who try to squeeze every drop of meaning out of words and lines. Then point four. A critic must also have highly developed sense of tradition. He must be learned not only in the literature of his own country, but in the literature of Europe, down from Homer to his own day. Point number five. Practitioners of poetry make the best critic. The critic and the creative artist should frequently be the same person. Such poet critics have a thorough knowledge and understanding of the process of poetic creation, and so they are in the best position to communicate their own understanding to their readers. Then point number six. An ideal critic must have a thorough understanding of the language and structure of a poem. He must also have an idea of the music of poetry. For a poet communicates as much through the meaning of words as through their sound. Point number seven. Comparison and analysis are the chief tools of a critic, and so a perfect critic must be an expert in the use of these tools. His use of these tools must be subtle and skillful. He must know what and how to compare and how to analyze. He must compare the writers of the present with those of the past, not to pass judgment or determine good or bad, but to elucidate the qualities of the work under criticism. In other words, he must be a man of erudition, for only they can use his tools effectively. Point number eight. He must not try to judge the present by the standards of the past. The requirements of each age are different, and so the canons of art must change from age to age. He must be liberal in his outlook and must be prepared to correct and revise his views from time to time in the light of new facts. The next subheading is his functions. The function of a critic is to elucidate works of art. This function he performs through the use of the tools of comparison and analysis. His function is not to interpret, for interpretation is something subjective and impressionistic. Critics like Coleridge or Goethe, who try to interpret works of art, are great corruptors of the public taste. They supply merely opinion of fancy, which is often misleading. The critic should merely place the facts before the readers and thus help them to interpret for themselves. His function is analytical and elucidatory and not interpretative. Analysis and comparison, catholicity and sensitiveness, intelligence, curiosity, intensity of passion, and infinite knowledge, all these are necessary to be a great critic. Point number two. The critic must also correct taste. He must educate the taste of the people. In other words, he must enable them positively to judge what to read most profitably and negatively what to avoid as worthless and of no significance. He must develop the insight and discrimination of his readers. Point number three. A critic must promote the enjoyment and understanding of works of art. He must develop both the aesthetic and the intellectual sensibilities of his readers. Then point number four. It is the function of a critic to turn the attention from the poet to his poetry. The emotion of art is impersonal, distinct from the emotion of the poet. The poem is a thing in itself, and it must be judged objectively without any biographical, sociological, or historical consideration. By placing before the readers the relevant facts about the poem, the critic emphasizes its impersonal nature and thus promotes correct understanding. Then point number five. Criticism must serve as a handmaid to creation. Criticism is of great importance in the work of creation itself. The poet creates, but the critic in him sifts, combines, corrects, and expunges, and thus imparts perfection and finish to what has been created. No great work of art is possible without critical labor. Point number six. The function of a critic is to find common principles for the pursuit of criticism. To achieve this end, the critic must control his own whims and prejudices and so cooperate with other critics in the common pursuit of true judgment. He must cooperate with the critics both of the past and the present. He must also realize that all truths are tentative and so must be ready to correct and modify his views as fresh facts come to light. Point number seven. The function of a critic is not a judicial one. A critic is not to pass judgment or determine good or bad. His function is to place the similar kinds of facts before the readers and thus help them to form their own judgment. He does not supply statements or communicate feelings. He merely starts off a process. A critic is a great irritant to thought. He tries to secure the active participation of the readers in the work of criticism. Point number eight. A critic should try to answer two questions. What is poetry and is this a good poem? Criticism is both theoretical regarding the nature and function of poetry and the poetic process, and practical concern with the evaluation of works of art. With this end in view, he should bring the lessons of the past to bear upon the present. In short, Eliot's conception of a critic and his functions is classical. He insists on a highly developed sense of fact, an objective standard, a sense of tradition, and rejects the subjectivism of the Romantics. The concern for a poem as an objective thing is the special highlight of the classicism of Eliot. Then point 7. Eliot's dramatic criticism. A dialogue on dramatic poetry, rhetoric and poetic drama. For Elizabethan dramatists, the possibility of the poetic drama, poetry and drama, Eliot's views on poetic drama and critical examination. The greatness of Eliot as a dramatist may be questioned, but there can be no denying the significance and value of his dramatic criticism. His dramatic criticism is contained largely in essays like The Four Elizabethan Dramatists, A Dialogue on Dramatic Poetry, Rhetoric and Poetic Drama. Then the next subheading is A Dialogue on Dramatic Poetry. The dialogue was written in 1928 as a preface to Dryden's discussion on the subject in his essay on dramatic poetry, and its form was suggested by Dryden's essay. It is in the nature of a discussion between six persons from A to G, E being Eliot himself. The form of the dialogue enables Eliot to discuss the problem of poetic drama from different angles. Different points of view are given, discussed, and ultimately a sort of consensus is arrived at. First, it is agreed that in the modern age, the problems connected with drama have become very complex, and so it is not possible today to frame and discuss laws of drama as it could be done by Aristotle and Dryden. In their age, the problems were not so complex and varied. They had not to consider the relation of drama to politics and to religion and ethics. But in the modern age, they must examine such relationships. Secondly, after much discussion, it is agreed that the aim of drama is not merely to provide amusement. Different dramatists may have different aims, but no dramatist can do without a moral attitude. Next, the problem of form in drama comes in for discussion. If there is to be a future for poetic drama, some suitable form must be evolved. The case of a Russian ballet is cited. The ballet, which imposes order and pattern on the movements of the dancer, has a permanent form, and this form arises out of a system of physical training and highly skilled movements. In other words, it is a kind of liturgy. The drama had its origin in the liturgy of the church. The Mass is a small drama, having all the unities, and a Mass well performed gives great dramatic satisfaction. The drama had its origin out of the Mass, and it cannot afford to cut itself from the ritual and liturgy of the Church. It can gain strength and vitality by a return of its source. No drama can be a substitute for religion, but its religious origin indicates the supreme importance of the moral or religious aim of the drama and of a suitable form. The form of modern drama can be either prose or verse. It is generally supposed that verse is artificial and that the emotional range and realistic truth are circumscribed by words. Such notions are wrong. The human soul, at moments of intense emotion, expresses itself in words. Prose drama merely emphasizes the ephemeral and superficial. If we want the permanent and universal, we must express ourselves in words. Hence arises the need of poetic drama. This leads to a discussion of a relation of poetry and drama. Eliot is against the separation of poetry and drama, Words and drama are not two separate things. Words is not something added to drama, rather it is integral and natural to it. All poetry tends towards drama and all drama towards poetry. In a really creative work, poetry and drama are fused together. In moments of dramatic tension, poetry becomes dramatic. The poetic pattern and the dramatic pattern are indistinguishable. The greatest drama is poetic drama, and dramatic defects can be compensated for by poetic excellence. Poetry is not a mere embellishment on drama. Poetry and drama are the two aspects of one and the same creative activity. Shakespeare's plays represent the complete fusion of the two. His finest poetry is to be met with in most dramatic scenes. The real defect of the Elizabethan and Jacobean dramatist is the absence of suitable dramatic conventions, and it is the absence of artistic conventions that comes in the way of poetic drama in the modern age. The modern world is chaotic, and its lack of moral, social, and artistic conventions make the revival of poetic drama difficult. Another difficulty is the common belief that a nation cannot have two great periods of drama. The Elizabethan age was the great period of English drama, and so to expect greatness in the modern age is futile. However, Eliot does not agree with such fatalistic views. The craving for poetic drama is permanent in human nature, and so its revival is possible in the modern age. The attempts made so far to revive poetic drama have failed either because the plays were written by poets who had no knowledge of the stage, or by those who knew the stage but were not poets. Poetic drama is possible, but it can be revived only when suitable dramatic conventions are evolved. First, they must find a new form of words which will be as suitable for them as blank words was for the Elizabethans. The dramatic convention of the three unities is highly desirable, for it makes for concentration and intensity. The unities do make for intensity, as does verse rhythm. The next subheading is rhetoric and poetic drama. In this short essay written in 1919, Eliot examines the nature of rhetoric and its place in poetic drama. In the modern age, rhetoric is out of fashion. It is used as synonymous with bad writing. The Elizabethan and Jacobean plays are condemned as rhetorical. This is a mistake. We should first try to understand the exact meaning of the word rhetoric. The assumption that rhetoric is only a fault of manner, a kind of mannerism, should be avoided. As a matter of fact, there is a rhetoric of substance as well, and such rhetoric is not bad. True rhetoric arises when there is an adaptation of our manner to the infinite variety of our thoughts and feelings on a variety of subjects. We find such an adaptation in Shakespeare, and hence we can say that he used rhetorical expression in the right way. On the other hand, Kyd and Marlowe are merely bombastic and dull, for they lack the ability to make such adaptation. The really fine rhetoric occurs in situations in which a character in the play sees himself in a dramatic light, or when some character in the play sees another character in a dramatic light. False rhetoric arises when a character in a play makes a direct appeal to us. A speech in a play must never appear to be intended to move us, the spectators. We should preserve our position as spectators and observe always from outside, though with complete understanding. In the modern age, there is a marked preference for conversational style, for the style of direct speech as opposed to the rhetorical style. But even this conversational style does often become rhetorical and is as remote from conversational style or direct speech as anything can be. The dramatist must adapt his style to the infinite emotions and feelings he has to express. Otherwise, even the so-called conversational style becomes rhetorical. Such dramatic sense is rare in modern drama. To write a successful poetic drama, it is necessary that the dramatist should take only the typical and universal human emotions and give them artistic form. Poetic sense and dramatic perception must be fused and the language varied according to emotion and feeling. In poetic drama, rhetoric is any inflation or adornment of speech which is not done for a particular effect but for general impressiveness. Rhetoric has a significant place in poetic drama, but it must be used artistically and dramatically. Thus, Eliot opposes excessive emphasis on realism in language. He favors a dramatic use of language.